Welcome to Try Lawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. This is a storytelling podcast, so we have great lawyers tell great stories from cases that had a profound impact on them. Today, we're lucky to have with us Balam Latona. Balam is a phenomenal trial lawyer from Santa Cruz whose practice focuses on wrongful debt collections and other types of financial torts, as well as trying cases for other lawyers. Balam is going to share with us a very interesting story that sheds light upon keeping your power in the courtroom and not letting anyone, including the judge, take away your power. So let's get started. Welcome to Try Lawyer Talk. Today we're very, very lucky to have with us Balam Latona. Balam is a wonderful, caring, sensitive, and kind human being and lawyer who cares a lot about his clients. Balam, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here speaking with you.
Balam, can you tell us about a case that had a profound impact on you?
Yes, I can. I am thinking about Albert Sonnet. He was born in 1918, and I had the absolute honor to represent him in a personal injury case. At the time, he was about 96, and some lawyers in the Santa Cruz area had called me and asked whether I would try that case. They had worked the case up to trial, and they weren't getting anywhere and trying to settle it. And so they gave me a call because they knew that that's what I like to do, is try cases. And I, the first thing I asked them was, well, tell me a little bit about the client. And they had me probably in the first 30 seconds of them explaining to me that he's 96, he is alert, he has a broken leg. That was the circumstances that precipitated the lawsuit. And at that point, I heard a little bit about the case and I wanted to meet him. And what I've learned in being a trial lawyer and being a lawyer for people is that when you want to learn about a case and want to pursue justice, you have to really get to know the person individually and learn their life story. At the time, Mr. Sonnet was in a rest home somewhere on the central coast. So I drove out about a week later. He was probably about 70 miles from my office. And I drove out to meet him, and he was immobile at the time. And he began to tell me all, I didn't really want to know as much about what had happened, but instead I wanted to learn about him and what brought him up to this 96 years. And I learned, I spent several different afternoons with him in the next following weeks. I learned quite a bit about his backstory, that his parents were originally from Holland and they came to this country sometime around 1870. And walking into his room where he was staying in this rest home, it was a hospital-like setting. And on the walls, he had different pictures of people. And there were all of them were in black and white. And he had a picture of his mother and his father. He had pictures of steamboats that we don't see nowadays. And he began to just weave this incredible narrative about his life story that I was just curious about. And one thing that struck me with Mr. Sonnet was that he had always been a principled man and very independent. And what had happened to him, that something happened to him that took away his independence. He was about 96. I think he had just turned 96. He was living alone. His son was a former sheriff of a county in the Central Coast, and his son wanted him to live with him, but Albert refused. Instead, he said, I want to live in this small little town, and I want to have my own place and live alone. So his son, of course, relented and let him. His wife, Albert's wife, had gotten sicker and sicker, and he couldn't care for her. So she was in, at this point in time, she was in a rest home, and Albert was living alone. And one night in the winter, there was a terrible storm that had hit the central coast of California, knocked out the power. It was raining. When the power was knocked out sometime around midnight, Albert stood up. He was about 6'4", and walked into the garage to turn off the gas. And he turned off the gas with a pair of pliers, and he put them in his dungarees. That's what he called them, but we'd call them jeans, right? And he went to sleep on the couch. He didn't go to sleep on the bed because he wanted to be ready for anything. And that's the kind of guy he was. I'll sleep on the couch when there's potential danger around. I'm going to be ready. And during the night, he rolled off of the couch, and he still had those pliers in his pocket, and he cracked his femur, and he had a broken leg. And so he was, the next day, he was rushed to the emergency room, and he, now understand, up to this point, he was completely mobile. He was driving, he was going everywhere, doing things. He was taking out the trash, doing his own laundry. He was had full independence. And he was in, they were able to successfully put in a metal rod, and then they sent him off to a different rest home that where his wife was not. It was in a different city, and he was recovering there. And when he got into the room, there was a Japanese American in the same room with him, a man about close to his age. And Mr. Sané grew up in a time where Japanese American were just thought of as Japs. Those were the words he used. And I remember listening to him use those words with me, and it stung me because I would never use a word like that. And my own personal experience has been just love and understanding from Japanese people. So I never thought for a moment that I would ever call a Japanese American a Jap. And so here I am sitting across from Mr. Sone, who's lying in his bed, and he tells me about that dirty Jap and how that dirty Jap came after him. And so if we go back to when Mr. Sone is brought into this room at this rest home to recuperate, he's lying in this room. It's close to midnight, and he is nearly sedated. Okay, he's disoriented. He's just come out of major surgery, and soon enough the drugs wear off, and early the next morning he wakes up and he opens his eye, and he sees what in his mind is a dirty Jap. Now, if you were to ask me, I don't think Mr. Sone would have ever said that if he hadn't felt something. It's not like he is a guy that would walk down the street and say that to someone who looks Japanese walking down the street. And this is the part of the story that really impacted me as a human being, but also as a lawyer, was to find out, well, this dynamic between Mr. Sone and his roommate is why did that happen? And to kind of skip forward a little bit, what happens is the next morning he wakes up and he sees this gentleman, and in his mind, this gentleman is being very aggressive towards him. He's not making sense. They start to argue back and forth. And at some point, the day goes, continues. His son visits him. His son is aware of this tension that's brewing, and he can see it. And he's assured that everything's going to be okay. Mr. Sone falls asleep later that night, and he then is woken up to this man pounding on his leg that has just been operated on. And he's just pounding on that leg, and Mr. Sané is helpless. He's trying to scream out, trying to get this man off of his body, and he is, at some point he's pulled off and taken somewhere else. But at the end of the day, Mr. Sané is never able to recover. He never is able to walk again after that. So the lawsuit was filed because of this attack on him. And the near certainty in Mr. Sané's mind, and also his son's mind, that if that attack had not happened, that he would have recovered fully. And he would have had a full recovery. And that the day after the surgery, he was up and walking and making progress, as you would expect someone to make progress. But after that, it wasn't as clear as it was the first day. And the thing that impacted me, of course, the most, and why I bring up this case, is because I felt that it was really the first time that I had an opportunity to go into the mind and explore the story from the perspective of the Japanese American who attacked him. And it was really important for me to understand him as a human being. So I found, of course, I then got involved in the case, and I found out this gentleman's name, and he hadn't been deposed at all, and it was Discover had already closed, so there was no hope to ever back up. He had not been deposed because he had passed away.
So you're trying to get inside the heart and the head and the mind of this elderly Japanese man who is now dead.
That's right.
How did you do that?
So the first thing I did is I picked up the phone and I called the lawyer that was representing his estate, because at some point before I ever got involved, this gentleman was named as a co-defendant, but because he had passed on and there weren't any assets to speak of, he had been dismissed out. And I picked up the phone and I spoke with the lawyer, and I simply told him that I am representing Mr. Sané, and I've done some research on this man. His name was Mitsugu Eto. I think he probably went by Mits, M-I-T-S, and his last name was Eto, E-T-O. And I learned through Google research that he was a member of the famed 442nd Regiment that fought in Europe for the United States, that I learned that his family had been interned during the war, that they were forced out of their home and sent away to one of these internment camps. And that it was in the internment camps that he eventually joined the army and went and fought valiantly for our country all through Europe. And I found different photographs of him that are online. The Japanese American community has done a tremendous job of preserving those photographs and also interviewing those people. And I know that he won many medals and honors in the military. And so when I picked up the phone and spoke with this lawyer, I expressed that to him. And I said to him that I believe that there's more there, that there's a story here that I want to hear about. I had known up to this point that he had fallen from a tree while trying to pick some apples in his backyard, and that's what had brought him to this rest home and into that room with Mr. Sané, and that he had a lot of head trauma, and he was taken to a local hospital, and he had to be tied down in the bed because he was striking out and hitting people. And I needed to know, I wanted to know more about him, and I really felt that his memory shouldn't be in a trial. I didn't want the focus of his memory to be someone who attacked my client, that I felt it important that the jury see that there were two victims in this particular situation, that the rest home hadn't done their job, and I had a meeting with his widow and his son, and I put together a collage of photos that I had found online, and I printed them out and I sat down with him, and that was the first thing I did is I took out those pictures and I showed it to his wife, and there were some pictures that she had never seen before. And we spent some time talking about his military history, and I learned about his story. And then I began to ask him about the fall that had happened and what changes that she saw. And it is an image that will never leave me, was her telling me that after he had been hospitalized and she could tell that he was out of his mind, that she would be at the hospital trying to calm him down. And here's a lady that's probably not even 4'6", probably weighs 70 pounds soaking wet, and she's trying to hold down her husband from attacking people, and he isn't getting the care that he needs. And that was an aspect of the story it really bothered me because of that, but I also knew that that was a story that a jury needed to hear. So after I had met them and kind of, you know, really understood their story, I then reshifted my attention back to telling that story at trial. And one of the things that I learned while looking into this is from Miss Edo, she started to tell me about her efforts to stop her husband from attacking other people. And I said to myself, well, there has to be nurses out there who know about this. And we were probably less than a month from trial, but I got the names of different nurses, and nearly most of them wouldn't return my phone calls, but there were two that did. And sure enough, I began to interview them, and they began to tell the story of the bruises that they had sustained from Mr. Edo, that the attacks that he would do, and that so it was so hard to control him. And what struck me was that one particular nurse, she described this in just from a place of love. And what she would say is that he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't really have control over him, but he should not have been at that facility. He should have been somewhere else where they could have controlled him, where they could have restrained him or done something to control him. And she didn't blame him at all for what had happened. And that aspect of her testimony, in my mind, was what was needed, a jury needed to hear. And that's kind of how I began to form the case, is from the perspective of that nurse, and also from the perspective of Mr. Edo's widow. And how do I reconcile that, though, with this dirty Jap? You know, because that's the rub, right? You have Mr. Sane, who says these things about Mr. Edo, and then you have Mr. Edo, who also has a story. And what I eventually realized was that, of course, that Mr. Sane was put in a situation where his emotions and his need to protect himself came out, and he was vulnerable at the time. This was a man who was entirely doing everything on his own. He was doing his laundry. He would try to paint his house. You know, he would rake leaves, and now he's sitting here, lying on a bed, prostrate, not able to move his legs or get out, and there's a danger in the room. And Mr. Edo was not only physically combative, but he was also verbally combative. And that was the story I needed to tell, but I also needed to address head on these racist comments. Mr. Sane probably he would deny that he said these things, and I didn't feel that that was the best way to go about denying it. It was just instead to embrace that and speak to the jury in voir dire about racism and different words that we use, and when we're in a vulnerable position, we sometimes revert to a more base level of how we react. If you think about...
And I assume that there was notes or records showing that your client had said these racist comments that would ultimately come out.
There were, yes, they had their expert that was going to testify about that. That's what he was going to talk about, was all of what I just mentioned.
So how did you deal with it?
What I did is I just embraced that, all of that. I didn't deny that it did not happen. Of course, I was going to put them to their proof, but I was not going to deny it. I wasn't going to make it an issue. I wasn't going to make it a factual stand, that, because I didn't see that we could really sustain that that piece of the evidence. But instead, I wanted to, and so how I attacked it is I began, or not attacked it or addressed it, is I began to identify some parts of my own story, my story as Balaam Latona, that I could identify with, that where I was racist or I did something discriminatory towards someone. I don't remember the exact story that I was going to use when speaking with the jury about that, but I felt it important enough that I had a story from my own past to give them permission to start speaking about that.
So to connect with your client and to share the truth of your client, you tapped into your own racist feelings to be able to identify with your client and identify ultimately with the jury.
Yes, I think that the only way to be a successful trial lawyer is to be transparent and honest. We're hearing a lot of talk nowadays about not being politically correct and being mindful of other people's feelings. And there's something to say to that when it comes to a jury. It's not a time to be politically correct. It's a time to really become real and to really discuss the dynamic that is occurring, that we all, I hear people, common people, they are asked, well, why do you support this one candidate? And they'll say, because he's saying what we're all thinking and we're afraid to say. And I think, and that is what needs to happen in a jury trial, is in order to really understand your client, you have to understand sometimes the truth is ugly. It's not pretty. It's absolutely horrendous. But you know, we don't all have our best days. And the reason why our justice system is set up, it's set up to, in my mind, to kind of find the truth behind those horrendous statements, you know, to really explore that. And that the only way I know how to do that is what I've been taught to do, is to find that truth in me, to find my own story, so people can have permission to start talking about that. Because we all know that when they go into the jury room, that's what they're going to be talking about. Maybe not, sometimes it's not going to come out verbally, but they'll have it in the back of their mind, and that's going to be really driving their decision. And so I'd rather speak about it during voir dire. And it's of course, it's not my train. They may take what I say and go a different direction, and I'm not going to, that's their train at that point. Let them talk about it how they want to talk about that issue. So at the end, this case came about, and I am probably 2 days into the case, and we ended up settling the case.
So about 2 days into the trial.
Yes, and we ended up settling, and I was very disappointed with how the settlement went down, and so was Mr. Sane's son, but it ended.
What do you mean, disappointed in how it went down?
Yeah, well, we were trying the case, and it was just me. I had an associate with me who was from this lawyer's office who had referred me the case, and he'd never tried a case before, and the methods that I was using were a bit different for him. They were kind of foreign, and we were getting rulings against us. The judge had pretty much disallowed all of the evidence that Mr. Eto had attacked other people previous to hitting my client. The only thing he allowed in was that Mr. Eto had struck a lady who was in a wheelchair. He had kind of just punched her in the chest while he was being wheeled down the hallway. But all of the other evidence found in the medical charts where these nurses had said combative, resisting, all of those, which kind of went on almost like a chronology day by day by day, he had excluded all of that evidence.
But how does that feel? So you're in trial, you've got your heart and soul connected with your client to tell his story, and then the judge essentially disallows you to tell his story. How did that make you feel?
It was devastating. I still haven't gotten over that feeling. I felt like I let Mr. Sanu down. I wish there was a magic carpet to take me back in time to redo it. I felt alone, and it's one of my biggest regrets when I look back on the different cases and trials I've had. And part of it is that I feel like I didn't do enough to fight for him. He eventually died a few years after that trial. I think it was a year and a half, maybe 2 years later. And devastation. I've had time to process that case and what it has given me is it's given me strength to not give up no matter how bad a case is going during trial, that not to just fight to the end. I realized in that case for the first time that I have to be willing to figuratively die in a case in order to win. And I don't mean win where we would get a victory and the jury would find for us, but to win for my client. Many times, as crazy as it sounds, people just want to be heard in trial. They want that moment where they can tell their story to a jury and to a judge, and they're not really interested in the money. Of course, that's how we spell justice in America. As crass as some people may think that is, money is what is paid in a trial. And what I've learned, though, is that Mr. Sane taught me that I need to give everything and I need to die. I need to put my ego aside and I need to pursue justice.
Let me have you explain a little more. When you say, I need to die, can you tell me more about that, what that means?
When I say that I need to die in a trial, that takes me back to Mr. Sane's trial, where I had in my mind a very difficult judge who I felt was personally attacking me and who was being petty, who was being mean, who was treating the other attorney as if they were old pals, and there was a running joke going between them that none of us knew about. And what I realized in that case was that I needed to let that judge kill me, and I needed to let him verbally assault me and do whatever it is that he was going to do to me. And I needed to be that punching bag for my client, that I needed to take that punishment. The judge would never in a million years ever direct that to Mr. Sane. He had too much respect for him. But to me, he was gladly doing that. And he did that, and that was when I came to the realization that I need to stand up and I need to take all of the verbal abuse and the emotional abuse from my client, and I need to be that one that's that punching bag. And if that means that I'm going to die emotionally, and then I'm going to let that happen. And that took a few days for me to realize that, because as you know, trials are usually called, and then there's some motions in limine, and there's a bunch of work that happens before you get to when a jury starts to come in. And that's when I started to realize how this was going to go down. And I was very scared the first day. I remember it was just very scary. And it finally took me a day to realize that. And
you said you remember having.
Well, I remember, you're not going to let me off the hook, are you? the very first day of trial, we were going through motions in limine, and we pretty much were losing everything that we wanted to get. And I had put too much emotional energy in my expectation of what was going to happen, that we were going to win these things. I put too much energy and emotional energy into a story that I was going to tell based on some of this evidence. And when we started to lose that and things were going just awful and this judge was rude, I left that hearing and I was, I had a panic attack. I never had a panic attack at that point. I felt like the world was collapsing around me. I felt alone. I didn't really have any other attorneys that I could lean on and talk about this and just kind of be real and open about what was happening with me inside. And once that happened, the next day came around, and that's when I had this epiphany that the only way I'm going to do well and not allow this panic attack to come back was to let go of this aspect of control that I wanted over maybe how the case was running, and let go of control of ever convincing this particular judge that we were right, and also let go of my idea of how he was controlling the case and how he was acting. That was probably a fiction in my mind, or maybe it wasn't. I mean, I certainly felt that way. And there were some other things that happened post-trial that I can't talk about because I've been instructed not to talk about by people higher up, I would say. And some good stuff did come out because of what had happened in that trial and the judge's, conduct. But once I gave up control of that, and I said to myself, I'm going to allow you to take all of your anger and all of your snide remarks. I'm going to give you permission to do that to me. Once I gave him permission to do that, he lost his power, and I was able to go forward. And I think maybe when I talk about I have to figuratively die, that meant that I had to give up and give the the judge permission to attack me and not let it affect me. Because before that, I was resisting his attacks and I was taking it personally. But then once I realized that this is how he is, and nothing is going to change, then once I turned that corner, then it was fine. Yeah.
That's wonderful, and what a great lesson. You know, I know that's a common experience among our colleague trial lawyers, of getting your ass kicked by a judge, having a trial seemingly where everything is going against you, and yet fighting for justice for your client while you feel like you're dying inside and being tortured inside. And that wonderful lesson that you shared with us of keeping your power and not letting that judge take your power is something that I've learned from you. So I want to thank you very much for that gift and the tremendous gift that you've given us today, and also, you know, the love that you show for your clients and creativity in your lawyering is very evident, and I'm really very thankful that you shared with us today, and very thankful for your clients that they have you as their lawyer.
Thank you for having me, Scott. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.